Off. How about we just start with some intros about you guys? Our guests, Gil, David. Why don't you guys go ahead and introduce yourselves? Gil, why don't we start with you?
Yeah, hi everyone. So my name is Guillaume Lambert. I'm a big user of DeFi, and I've been intrigued by Uniswap V3 since launched last year. So you can find some of my writings on my Medium blog, but otherwise I'll be happy to tell you guys about what I've discovered about Uniswap V3 here.
Awesome. Thanks, Gil.
I guess I'll.
Yeah, I can jump into it.
Cool. I'll go next. Yeah, my name is David. I'm a developer. I've worked on a number of projects. And regarding Uniswap, I've worked on a few projects. Building contracts associated with it. Both of the main ones that come to mind are around incentivization. That would be I built an incentivization contract for staked ETH, the staked ETH contract for Lido, and now this like staked similar staking contract on top of the one that was built by the Uniswap team, and that was for kind of layer twos and funded by synthetics and stuff like that. So yeah, so I understand it a bit at a technical level. I'm also just a user. I really like Uniswap V3. I think it's an amazing piece of software. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Awesome. Yeah, just for some background for the audience, Gil and David sort of did a collaboration on doing some modifications to the original Uniswap V3 contract. And so they have like really good in-depth knowledge of what it can do. And that's why we brought him here today. Okay, why don't we just start with something really basic? Gil, maybe if you could give us like a brief rundown on what the difference between Uniswap V3 and Uniswap V2 are. And like what's possible in Uniswap V3 that isn't on Uniswap V2 or other AMMs in general?
Sure. So I guess the world of AMMs has been dominated by the X times Y equals K formula for, I guess, the past 3 years almost. The idea is that this is a very easy way to automate the swapping of one asset from another. So you don't have to worry about order books or setting a specific price. With Uniswap, again, and also Banker and some other protocols, it enabled the easy swapping between two assets. And as long as there is some amount of tokens available in the contract, you're able to swap against it. So the price may go up as you buy more of it. But at the end of the day, the pricing, the exchange is done very simply using Uniswap V2, or kind of what was there for the past 3 years again. With Uniswap V3, this was kind of the next iteration in the world of AMMs. Uniswap V3 team kind of did a lot of tremendous research, and the made it, I guess, a bit more complicated, but at the same time, a lot more capital efficient. And what they done in Uniswap V3 is that they enabled the users or the liquidity providers to specify a certain range at which their liquidity will be active. So if you're in a ETH, a stable coin pool, for instance, you can say, I can only provide liquidity between the prices of 1,000 to 5,000, for instance. So that will make your tokens active only within that range, but if the price falls outside of this range, you don't collect fees. But the advantage is that because it's limited, you actually concentrate your liquidity, and you can achieve capital efficiencies that are up to several thousand, 2,000 times more capital efficient than Uniswap V2. So at the end of the day, Uniswap V3 enabled the increase in revenue for LPs, but the drawback is that it became a little bit more difficult to manage because you had to maybe adjust your ranges or maybe rebalance when the price went outside of your initial range.
Awesome. Thank you, Gil. And obviously, with many people are familiar with Uniswap V2, the full range liquidity provision, and liquidity mining on that sort of XYK curve, and the simplicity of it, where they just deposit LP tokens into this contract, and it would rebalance itself, and it would also accrue rewards based on how much pool share you have. So of course, with Uniswap V3, this became a little bit more complex, as you mentioned, and because not all liquidity is in range at all times, managing it was not only managing it was a little bit of complicated, but also providing liquidity for liquidity mining rewards also became a little bit more nuanced. So what Uniswap Labs did, or someone a contributor close to Uniswap Labs released a staking contract that basically rewarded liquidity based on how whether it's in the utilization curve or if it's being utilized at the time. Gil, do you want mind like giving us a bit of a rundown on Uniswap V3 Staker?
Yeah, sure. So, again, staking enables the other protocols to reimburse or to reward LPs by again giving them tokens again when their liquidity is used. So with Uniswap V2, as Millie mentioned, it was very easy. As long as you had funds in the pool, you would collect fees. You can collect rewards. It was very simple because you would provide liquidity at all prices. Now with the staker contract, again, this the fact that it was arranged or bounded liquidity provision was it made it a bit more difficult. So the way this worked is that the rewards were based off of the amount of time the user was in range. So if your bounds is very large, you'll be in range for a long time. If you're very narrow, for instance, one tick wide, which is it could be as little as half a percent, as long as you're in range, you collect fee. So this one side of the reward was based at time based. So the longer you're in range, the more fees you collect. But at the same time, it rewarded the concentration of liquidity. So if you're tick wide, you collect fees only when you're in range. If you're two ticks wide, you collect half the fee. If you're 10 ticks wide, you collect a tenth of the fee. So if you can imagine, half a percent is one tick, you typically want to go plus or minus maybe 10%, 20%. So that means that the effective reward, even though we were in range for a very long time, the effective reward might have been hundreds of times smaller than a single tick.
Perfect. Thanks. David, do you have anything to add to that?
I can talk about, well, should I talk about kind of the ups and pros and cons of it, or is that the next question?
I it probably leads into the next question. What I wanted
I
to
guess
touch on. Yeah, go
I
ahead.
guess I'll add, but before we jump to the next question, I'll add that a lot of this complexity comes from the fact that Uni V3 positions are not fungible. So I think many people are used to in Uni V2 and most AMMs, when you deposit liquidity, you get a fungible, ERC20 type token. And so that makes it very easy to kind of compose these tokens into other applications, because if I add $10 and someone else adds $10, those positions are fungible. If I add $10 and someone else adds $5 twice, that's, fungible. So that's what traditional like liquidity mining things do. With V3, even if two people add the same amount of money to the same positions, the positions are still not fungible, because Uniswap V3, unlike most AMMs kind of compound your the rewards you earn, they compound those into your position. With Uniswap V3, like the rewards you earn are kept separately, which is what makes these positions non-fungible. So Uniswap V3 positions are NFTs, which a lot of people kind of thought was cool, and they have a cool like graphic for them. But the fact that they're non-fungible is I think kind of one of the root causes of why things like liquidity staking are a bit more complicated.
Absolutely. Thank you for that, David. And when it comes to the liquidity mining reward contract, there's like this very famous reference that everyone has, right? It might not be too famous, but everyone who thinks about UniV3 staking and liquidity mining rewards, they think back to the Ribbon liquidity mining incentive program, because I think they're one of like the first projects to actually incentivize liquidity using Uniswap V3 on mainnet. And so just to give some context to the audience, what happened was Ribbon essentially launched a liquidity mining program when their token launched, and what ended up happening is that gas was pretty expensive at the time, and the token was brand new on the market. The initial and only source of liquidity was that pool, and so what ended up happening was a lot of large token holders or even bots were able to provide liquidity on the one tick mark, like really tight narrow range for that liquidity, and essentially earned like a ton of rewards out of the reward contract, and not leaving much for the other liquidity providers. A lot of people thought this was problematic and sort of changed the dynamics of liquidity mining, maybe made it like infeasible, maybe made the incentives like misaligned with in the program that was the way it was supposed to be, and the distribution wasn't fair. I personally have like an interesting take on it. I think that for the most part it functioned how it's supposed to. But also, I feel like, and I actually saw Gil mentioned this, on Twitter, and it sort of reminded me, sort of refreshed me that the one of the main issues that came with that, aside from the fact that yes, gas is very expensive on layer one, and providing liquidity in really tight range and constantly rebalancing that is not feasible for many holders, but also the fact that the token was brand new and didn't have a secondary source of liquidity to arb between that pool with. And because price discovery was 100% within that pool, there was the problem of the people who were providing liquidity on one tick were able to control the price as they were earning these rewards. So it was very difficult to move it out of their range. And if you did, it would only be by a little bit, and they would rebalance their portfolio really quickly. And these were large token holders who could afford the gas. And so what ended up happening was they actually held the price into a really tight range for a long time, and were able to extract a lot of rewards. Now, personally, I think that's a double-edged sword, but I'll touch on that in a bit. But I think if it was any other token that had a secondary liquid market like Ethereum or any other token that is tradable on a centralized exchange or even on other AMMs on other chains, it probably wouldn't have had the same issue because the liquidity providers wouldn't be able to control the price and earn the rewards at the same time. Because it would be one or the other. Like if it was ETH, USDC, for example, they would provide liquidity really tight range, but they can't control the price of ETH. ETH can move out of the range really quickly, and if it does move out of their range, that there's tight little range that they're in, they'd have to rebalance. And when they rebalance, it'd probably take a risk of impermanent loss. So they'd be taking a really big risk trying to provide really tight liquidity on that range. Gil, maybe you could talk about this a little bit and sort of expand on it.
Sure. So let me go back also to the first few days of the ETH-driven pool. So this was, again, as Emily said, it was a new token that was only released on mainnet. And as a consequence, many people wanted to contribute. A lot of trading activity happened. And because of this, the price was highly volatile. And that was also that the reason why also it was volatile, it was because it wasn't met with enough liquidity. So if you were to compute the volatility of this asset, for the first few days, it would be in the thousands of percent. So if you look at GameStop, it might have been 200% at its high in volatility. Here with Ribbon, it was 1,000 or 2,000% because the activity was high and the liquidity was low as well. So that also contributed to, again, the first few days were extremely chaotic. The price was moving a lot. And when the incentivization came in, that, as Melissa said, the larger players or maybe whales were able to provide liquidity at the currently traded tick. So what was now thousands of percents of volatility, because there was no liquidity, meant you had a few million dollars worth of liquidity at the current tick. So as a result, the actual volatility collapsed to the low 20s%. So just because you added liquidity, it stabilized the price. This decreased the volatility way below what, again, other cryptocurrencies are. For instance, ETH. USDC is about 80% on average. So here, this was oversupply of liquidity. It meant that the volatility was much lower. So it's good for the traders. They were able to kind of have a more stable price. And that also kind of on its own could have helped stabilize the market. But then as we know, the incentive for providing that concentrated liquidity was to collect the most reward and again, collect the Ribbon reward that was determined by the staking fee. So again, there were one or two players that, two or three players that ended up collecting a lot of the available reward from the Ribbon pool. I think Revert Finance and a few other people had tweet threads where about, again, 80% of the expenditures of all the Ribbon rewards went to these one tickers or one tick users. And again, you can think that a normal user that has maybe a couple of ETH worth of liquidity could have done this. But as Mini said, the gas was high. Providing liquidity meant you had to deploy liquidity in Uniswap, transfer the NFT position to the staker contract, and then when you want to rebalance, you have to remove, withdraw from the staker contract, burn the position, mint a new one, and redeploy it. So overall, you had four operations that needed to be done every time you had to adjust. When gas prices were high, this could mean, I mean, almost half an ETH worth of fees. If you have $1 million, it's not a lot. If you have your smaller player, then that could eat away into your profits very easily. So you can think that the Ribbon reward was compensating for these changes, and they were able again to collect the vast majority of the rewards and also collect the and do it in a way that was kind of capital efficient on their side.
Yes, thank you, Gil. David, I know you probably have some thoughts on this as well.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that I don't think has been mentioned, and maybe Gil, you have some insight on this. But one thing I heard was that the not only like could the whales, they have the capital to kind of pay the large transaction fees and chase this like one tick liquidity, but that they could also, so say you're in the one tick, you have a lot of capital in that one tick, you earn a lot of rewards, and then the price moves up a little bit and it moves out of your one tick range. Now, one thing you could do would be to pull all your capital and kind of adjust it into the next tick up. But you could also just hold any accrued rewards, or you're remember like earning reward in the token that's being traded, and then you could sell to push the price like back down into range. Farmers are probably selling anyways at some point. Like you're farming this new token, you want to sell it for ETH or for stables. So if you sell it once it's out of range, you can push it back into range. So, one of the I think criticisms of the Ribbon mining, liquidity mining was that these farmers were potentially like artificially keeping the price low, because by kind of selling at the right time, it would kind of keep them in range. Now, I don't know how much truth there is to this, because you could assume most farmers are probably somewhat selling anyways, and that maybe they were just kind of optimizing their selling. But I think that was part of the discussion. Gil, do you have any kind of insights on that?
Yeah, and that's true. And I want to add one thing as well, is that in most pools, I mean, price movements are expected. Someone wants to buy, someone wants to sell. So it's very difficult to maintain the price where you want, regardless of how much liquidity you've got. So again, being able to push it back towards the current tick was one advantage, but also being able to adjust this, it's also an advantage. So the width of a Uni V3 position, again, this is everybody that LPs into Uniswap V3, they have to make a choice as to how wide they want their position to be. And if you're full range, you'll be 100% of the time inside the range. If you're a single tick, the price will move out of that tick very quickly. So there's a time component that should enter into the equation whenever you want to choose a range. So again, plus or minus 10% on a ETH stablecoin pool, for instance, means that you'll be in range after you'll be kicked out of range on average after 7 days or a week. If it's wider, 25%, it could be a couple of weeks or a month. And if you are plus or minus 200%, you can be within range for 3 months on average, regardless of what the market conditions are. So the key point is that if you start with a range, you have to have a timeline in mind. And that's what, again, should guide the small retail users whenever they LP. But for the one tick wide position, if you do the calculation, you would need to rebalance on average, not every day, not every hour, but actually every 15 minutes. So for these highly volatile assets, if you're within, say, half a percent or even 0.3% or even less, you would need to be rebalancing every 15 minutes. So unless you have a bot running, unless you're 24/7 on your computer, you won't be able to match this. So that's kind of the idea as well of, I mean, having larger whales that didn't care about the fees as well, but they may have also bots or other ways to keep within the range much more efficiently because they had kind of the way to rebalance every 15 minutes. It could be every 2 hours, it could be every 5 minutes, but at the end of the day, they were able to track it a little bit more efficiently than, say, the retail user.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to kind of add to the whole discussion was, one chat, we're talking a lot about this, the Ribbon example where this is this token launch. Just in general, automated market makers are really not good at price discovery. Ideally, if you're kind of launching a new token, you would do something like a Dutch auction or something where you could kind of allow the price to be discovered based on what people actually like price that token at, as opposed to kind of this very illiquid, decentralized exchange. I think the main reason we don't see that is that, the way most tokens are launched is there's some kind of airdrop. To do something like a Dutch auction, that kind of implies selling the token. So that would be kind of a token sale, closer to like an ICO. And of course, for kind of regulatory reasons, most projects don't want to be selling things that could potentially be viewed as securities. So they opt to just give everybody tokens and let a secondary market form. And the selling point for a secondary market is obviously Uniswap. So, I guess to add to that a little bit, I do think that things have Uniswap V3 has improved this a bit. That kind of concentrated liquidity does allow liquidity providers to be a bit more opinionated on what they think the actual value is and put it in range. And you can see that, again, I don't have any numbers to back this up, but I remember token launches on Uniswap V2 where the price would swing really, really wildly in the first few, hours. And then if you look at, say, the Optimism's token launch, last week, I think, it definitely had volatility in the early days because, again, automated market makers are still not ideal, but I do think the concentrated liquidity has improved that. And in the case of something like Ribbon, this one tick liquidity, maybe it didn't really allow for a wide range of, maybe it kind of affected that price discovery a bit, but it did allow, reduce the volatility. The market makers were holding the price kind of steady, letting people buy and sell at that given price.
Yeah, David, definitely you made a really good point there. And it kind of ties back into what Gil was saying as well, like how when they provide that liquidity in that after the first moments of the launch, before the rewards went live, token was very volatile, and then all of a sudden the volatility dropped to like 20%, as Gil said. So I think another thing that is worth to mention in this as well is that the Ribbon launch, like this is my speculative opinion, and I don't, you guys can or cannot comment on it, but I felt like, when Ribbon launched, right, it had a total supply of 1 billion. That was the fully diluted valuation. The token launched at a pretty high price, and at the time we were in a bull market, but a $4 to $5 billion valuation for it, like the token was trading between $4 and $5 in the first few days. Actually, in the first week, to be honest. And I think, if for like Ribbon, for those that you don't know, it's a basically an aggregator for derivatives for options. It's a great product, but in my opinion, it's pretty one-dimensional in terms of what it is. And this is my speculative opinion. Others may not agree. Please don't roast us. But this is just my opinion, and I feel like it's kind of one-dimensional. But trading at at a $5 billion valuation, I felt like it was pretty like high. And I feel like, many people felt like the reward is for the liquidity mining rewards kind of made it so that it wasn't fair to the community, but at the same time it sort of held the token, like the one tickers, the whales or the people who game the rewards, they sort of held the price stable at a, at a level that maybe that token wouldn't have traded at otherwise. And for those who are familiar with Ribbon would remember that on the launch day of the token, there was a lot of negative publicity about the airdrop, and that was because the token was sibbled and airdrop farmed by many people, but namely by some of the investors backing Ribbon, and they actually publicly admitted it later. So there was a lot of negative publicity. Yet this token still traded at a really high valuation with relatively low volatility after, like as Gil mentioned, after the token launched. And to David's point, these whales were able to like control the price and keep it in this narrow range. But like, maybe not a very narrow range, but like reasonably comparatively to other airdrops in like a steady range, and they were able to extract these rewards. So I feel like, it's a double-edged sword where many people say that the Ribbon liquidity mining program actually failed because it didn't distribute rewards fairly. But I would also say that, the unfairness of the distribution of the rewards was made up for by the fact that this token traded at such a high valuation for many days. And of course, if you look at like the Ribbon chart, the all-time high was on the first week of launch, right? At the time of the liquidity mining rewards contract. So I feel like, it has to be taken with a grain of salt as to how effective the Uniswap V3 contract is or isn't. Sorry, that people, spread this sort of misconception, in my opinion, that it's not effective. I feel like it was effective for what it did, and it sort of, held the liquidity and provided stability to the price and liquidity at a price that otherwise it shouldn't have traded at. And the other thing, and hopefully Gil, maybe you could comment on this. In your opinion, if the other tokens, right, like let's say something like ETH, USDC, do you think one tickers would still be able to take advantage of draining rewards for, let's say, like a liquidity mining program for ETH USDC the same way they would for like maybe something without an external pool like Ribbon without taking like a high risk on their position?
Yeah, so I think it, I mean, of course, it depends on the rewards. So you still have to be compensated by the extra risk of being very narrow. But yes, again, as I mentioned, if you want to be very wide in your position, that means you have to rebalance every few days or few weeks. If you are very narrow, it's a perfectly fine strategy. You just have to rebalance much more frequently, perhaps even several times a day. So that on its own, because you can rebalance, you get slightly more fees themselves, not even rewards, but the fees that are collected. But you are very narrow, you collect more fees, and that's kind of your reward on its own. But then what, I guess the reason why maybe the staking contract wasn't working as intended is that the one tickers could benefit from the fees. They would collect a large amount of the fees, but also because of the concentration of their liquidity, they would also collect most of the reward. Again, if you're two ticks, you collect half as much of the reward, half as much as the fee. And you may still have again enough funds, but the regardless of how volatile it is, your the optimal strategy would be as narrow as possible, rebalance as frequently as possible, and hope that the rewards will compensate for your fees, for your risk. But because any other strategy that's wider will be kind of at a loss compared to that extreme concentrated liquidity strategy. So we're even so the ETH stablecoin, of course, it can be arbed. Of course, it can match what happens on centralized exchanges, but it doesn't mean that you can't benefit from having everyone take wide position.
I see. Okay. Just to retrace back to your original point, you said that Ribbon was trading at like 20% volatility in the for after the rewards contract went live. Can you maybe just say in what relation, like what that 20% represents in terms of volatility?
Sure. So this is also part of my research, I guess. I have a fork of the Uniswap Analytics website where I do publish the realized volatility and also implied volatility that's caused by the trading. But yes, I mean, the high end of the volatility, you have GameStop, the tokens that just launched can be several hundreds up to thousands of percent. This is it can change, and it's analyzed, so it can change 10x if it's 1,000% per year on average, say 60% of the time. When you have 20%, this is actually very low. This is similar to the S&P 500 aggregate of 500 of the largest companies in the US. This one has a IV, I mean, implied volatility of 20%. So that means on average, you're within that plus or minus 20% range after a year. It can be higher, it can be lower, but that's kind of what the math tells you. So here you have a very, very volatile coin that just launched. Perhaps people were selling, dumping, buying the token itself. And because of the increase in volatility, the effective, again, the increase in liquidity, the effective volatility was kind of very, very, very low. So as I mentioned, it's good for the traders. You could have a very stable price. And that's a direct consequence of having all the liquidity concentrated at the current tick.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for that, illustration. Actually, Gil also just shared his visualizer of the Uniswap V3. Matt kindly put post pinned it to our space so you can find it at the top. And I feel like so what you're saying is the liquidity that was provided sort of brought the brought the volatility of this token down to that of the S&P 500, which is extremely low in crypto standards. So I guess it does make the point that like these LPs were able to control the price mainly because there was no other external liquidity source to like arbit out of, correct?
That's correct. So I guess the cost of stabilizing that price, again, because it only lived on mainnet, there was no way to trade it, and there was a lot of liquidity for the trading amount. Yeah, if the expenditures of the Ribbon team was to stabilize the price, I guess they succeeded, and they paid a few one tickers to kind of do that job. But yes, and again, we can go to the broader perspective. Again, if it's something that they could hire someone to do this professionally, they didn't have to be, maybe spend as much tokens. But then also, if the smaller user wanted to be participating in the liquidity mining rewards, it would be priced out almost immediately because they weren't able to keep up with these larger whales.
You made a really interesting point there in terms of if they were ha to sort of source this out to market professional market makers, they may have had to pay the same amount, which is an interesting point on its own. Okay, maybe we move on to the next part, which is the next discussion really adjacent to this one. As a result of this sort of like debacle or like all this discussion, all these discussions around the Ribbon token launch, a lot of people shied away from using the Uniswap V3 staker. So what we ended up seeing, though, was a proposal that came up from Lido Cohen. I'm not sure if he's in the audience right now or not, but he made a proposal to launch incentive program on layer twos on Ethereum, so Arbitrum and Optimism. And he wanted to do it on Uniswap. He wanted to use Uniswap V3 staker, and he wanted to like use a Uniswap token for liquidity mining. He made this really great in-depth proposal. And sort of as the discussions that came out of that proposal initially, you and David were a part of it and sort of came up with this idea to modify the contract in such a way to make it more easier for the smaller players to participate and to have a more fair distribution in the rewards and the Uniswap incentives that would come from the reward contract. Do you guys maybe want to tell us a little bit about how you came to that idea and like maybe a breakdown of how of what the modifications are?
Yeah, I think I'm going to jump off with this and I'll tie it into kind of what we were just discussing or to back up a little bit. I think it's important to talk about what are the goals of doing a liquidity mining campaign and what are the goals when you're essentially paying people to provide liquidity. You know, so one of the goals is for there to be liquidity there, you know, especially when you can
mine. Sorry, David, sorry to cut you off. I just want to let you know your mic is really distant.
Let me see if I can fix it now. Does it sound any better now?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Sorry. Okay, cool. I think my headphones are a little weird. Yeah, so I was saying that we should take a look at what are the goals of doing a liquidity mining or a yield farming campaign. So part of it is just to have liquidity. This is especially important when a token launches. You're going to have a lot of buying, a lot of selling, and you want there to be some liquidity so that the price isn't moving too much. And, you know, again, to kind of defend the ribbon situation a little bit, not that it went perfectly, but you could, there was so much liquidity in this one tick that, you know, the whales were really holding that liquidity tight. You could buy and sell RBN without moving the price at all. So by that metric, it was very successful. It provided, you know, very good liquidity, you know, at the current price. The other goal, and the one where it didn't work quite as well, is, you know, it's kind of just a distribution mechanism where you want to, you know, a lot of these tokens, you've done some kind of airdrop, and, you know, the airdrop already, you give tokens to a lot of different people. You want to have a widely distributed token set, and liquidity mining is another way that you can kind of give, you know, individual users the opportunity to get access to this token. Maybe they missed the airdrop. Maybe you want to kind of pay them to not sell their airdrop. That's kind of essentially one of the effects of doing this. And so that was one area where the Ribbon one kind of failed, is that it was very difficult for anyone without a large amount of capital to participate in that. So yeah, to kind of flash forward to what Lido has proposed with Uniswap. First of all, this proposal was for assets that are trading on other exchanges, assets that are already very liquid. So, you know, it was never like, oh, we want to make sure that there's a lot of liquidity for the ETH-USD pair, because otherwise ETH will be volatile, because it's like most of the Ethereum pricing is going to come from centralized exchanges anyways. It's more a sense of, you know, on one goal is to have liquidity on these layer twos. But also it's just to, you know, kind of pay users to use these layer twos, pay users to kind of do some behavior that we think is beneficial for the ecosystem. And in this case, it's to, you know, be on Optimism and Arbitrum. So, you know, the challenge there is how do we make sure that small users can still earn, that the whales don't have this massive advantage. And what we decided is just to allow an optional minimum tick width. So this would be that there's a minimum amount of ticks that you must provide liquidity to in order to kind of have qualify and earn rewards. And that means you can't do that whale game where you only provide to one tick of liquidity. You'd have to provide liquidity amongst a wider range, which, you know, is kind of somewhere in between. You know, with Uniswap V2, you have to provide full range. Essentially, everybody's providing the full range, which means everything is very, you know, equal. You know, small users have kind of the same, you know, they don't need to rebalance. So they have the same opportunity that whales do. It's not like the Ribbon one where, you know, you can provide one tick and earn all the rewards. So it's kind of finding that middle ground where we could still let small users participate, but still get, some of these concentrated liquidity benefits that V3 gives us.
Yeah, and if I can add also, so the maybe one of the problems with the current implementation is, again, they would factor one the concentrate the how concentrated a position was. So the more concentrated it was, the more fees it would collect. So the fees, just trading fees. But then when the staker contract was also computing, they would factor both the liquidity that is deposited, but also the time spent inside. So again, the fact that you concentrate the rewards, you distribute the rewards to the most concentrated positions, also made it again a bit more difficult for the smaller users that could not again adjust every few hours to be in the range. So that's kind of the idea behind the fixing a minimum width. So that's going to be at the discretion, I guess, of the protocol that uses the new contract. But at the end of the day, they specify perhaps plus or minus 5%, 10%, 20%. And each of these ranges correspond to perhaps a rough timeline as to how frequently you have to rebalance. And most of the time, that should be enough for the small user if they do it every day to kind of rebalance if needed, or if they're happy with their position out of range, it can still remain out of that.
Awesome, perfect. And maybe if you guys could just give us some insight into like what the exact changes were on the contract level to the original contract.
Yeah, so it's actually the key change is incredibly small. It's when you create a liquidity mining campaign, there's now a field called minimum tick width. I guess to explain ticks, we've talked about ticks a little bit. A tick is just kind of an arbitrary. You can imagine like Uniswap V2 assets trade on a curve. You can imagine like a curve on a chart, kind of going along the X and Y axis. You could imagine dividing that curve into, 1,000 or, it's much higher than that, but dividing it into a bunch of little segments. When you deposit into Uniswap V3, you're basically picking which segments you're going to provide to. And so the unit of those segments is called ticks. So we said, there's a minimum amount of ticks that you can choose to have a minimum amount of ticks that a position has to span, which means, positions need to be wider, wider positions don't need to be rebalanced as often. So again, yeah, that primary change was a couple lines of code, because when you deposit, it just checks how many ticks your position spans. There was some other work that we did as part of this work, which was a lot of it was kind of like optimizations for layer two. The gas, there's very different gas optimizations for a smart contract on a rollup like Arbitrum or Optimism compared to on layer one. So we kind of improved the gas optimization. We also made it so when you, I said Uniswap V3 positions are NFTs, and to stake, you deposit this NFT. We made it so that staked positions are also NFTs. So you have something in your wallet that represents kind of this asset that's being staked and earning rewards, and you can even transfer that to other users if you want. So yeah, those were kind of the code changes.
Great, thank you guys. I actually, to be honest, like the modifications you guys made, there's a good chance that Synthetics ends up using them on Optimism for our OP incentive program, just because like the changes you guys made are so like useful for what we want to do. And actually, I also think that like LP, like using the Uniswap V3 staker and just in general on layer two is just more effective, just because it takes away that one aspect of the fact that not everyone, or you don't have to have a position of a certain size to be able to afford rebalancing your liquidity. So yeah, we're definitely going to take draw that from you guys. Thank you for drawing it up and designing it. I kind of want to talk about a little bit about different strategies that we see over time people deploying on Uni V3, because I feel like there's also other like a lot of discussions in general around the fact that Uniswap V3 very much caters to like professional market makers. Gil, maybe you could give us some insight into this. What strategies do you see being effective on Uniswap V3 these days for LPing in general? It could be for any pair, to be honest.
Yeah, sure. So again, what started as a summer project last summer for me, trying to research Uniswap V3 on my own to find the best strategies, it kind of brought me to write articles, to actually fork the Uniswap interface to make it a bit more useful to me. Again, I this has been published now. I published a flowchart to help beginners kind of choose the range. And even now, so I'm working with the launching of Panoptic, which is a options protocol built on top of UniV3 that kind of uses a lot of these ideas. And again, for context, the way that I see LPing is actually very similar to selling options. So again, selling an option is something that you've seen with, say, Ribbon. You can sell covered call vaults or short puts. The act of providing liquidity is the same thing. You can sell a covered call. You can sell a short put as well. And that should be the mindset you have when you provide liquidity. You don't need to necessarily worry about impermanent loss, but if you understand these positions are options, that allows you to kind of make some choices. So in the flowchart, and again, what Panoptic enables is that you can also buy options or borrow that liquidity from someone else and get an exposure to a long option, a long call or a long put, for instance. So I could see that the way that people manage their LP positions will be much more options like, and you could draw in for the world of options trading to kind of guide your strategy. So if I want to concentrate on this flowchart, the key point that every user has to kind of make or decision is how long do you want to hold your position. Again, if you want to hold it for one block, you can be very narrow. If you want to hold it for 1 year, you have to be much larger. So I kind of provided a few kind of values, but at the end of the day, that should be your first decision. And that will also be guiding what the staker perhaps contract is how long do you want your users on average to be rebalancing their position? So again, plus or minus 7% is about every day, plus or minus 40% is every month. So you can actually go through the flowchart and decide, okay, I want to have a medium timeline, say a month. And also one key point is that you have to... You can be directional in your LPing. If you think a token will increase in price, that's one set of strategy. If you think it's going to decrease in price, there's another set of strategies. If you want to remain neutral, there's also a few strategies that are involved there. So at the end of the day, if you want to be bearish, you can borrow some of the token and use and lock this into the LP position. If you're neutral, you can borrow half of the tokens that you're deploying. If you're bullish, you can just deploy what you have. And at the end of the day, that will guide whether if the price goes up, you're profitable. If the price goes down, if you're bearish, you can also be profitable. So just by kind of selecting these two initial parameters, which is the timeline of your position and also the outlook you have on the market, that should be enough for you to every day perhaps just look at your position, see if you're in range. That's okay. You keep it for an extra day. If you're out of range, you just have to burn the position and redeploy. If you're happy with the fees that you've collected. So again, these strategies, again, in the flowchart are very similar to what you have in options trading. Again, you don't always have a positive outcome or a positive delta strategy. You can be delta neutral as well. But that's kind of what you have to keep in mind whenever you deploy these positions.
That's really great the way you illustrated that, Gil. Actually, you know, the fact that it's similar to options is really interesting because you mentioned, you know, it sort of has a lot to do with the implied volatility of the token and how long you want to provide liquidity. So, you know, to ask you a question, what do you think is the best way to sort of hedge? You mentioned being delta neutral. What's the best way to be delta neutral on a Uniswap LP position without like having to run like a really complicated bot that sort of does some high frequency trading on a
exchange? Sure. So you can do the good news that you can do all of it on chain. And it's very easy now with lending protocols. So I'm a big fan of Order Finance, but the same thing can be done on Compound, Aave, or Rabi Capital when it works. But you don't have to hedge with perpetuals or even centralized exchanges. If you want to deploy a delta neutral position, say you have a Ribbon, if you go back to the Ribbon example, you have some Ribbon. You want to participate in the Ribbon pool, but you have a neutral outlook, I guess, on the token. You provide, say, one ETH of your own wallet, and you borrow one ETH worth of Ribbon. So I don't know, it might be a few thousand Ribbon, but you borrow this, say, on Order Finance.
It's in the call. They will be recording it. And if anyone who missed it, we apologize. We will post this link, and we'll post a recording, and you could listen to it afterward. I'm very sorry about that. Gil, why don't you continue where you left off? Apologies for the interruption.
Yeah, sure. So the question was about what's the best strategy to be, say, delta neutral in any token that you want to LP in without having to, say, use centralized exchanges or futures or any ways to kind of constantly hedge it. So I did mention how, I guess, in my the flow chart, but how generally even me as an LP do it. I typically use a token of choice that I want to LP in and borrow that token and supply my own ETH. So most pools are ETH tokens. So you can go on, say, Order Finance, Compound, Aave. You can borrow that token. So when you lock it in the LP position, you do it at 50-50% of asset A of your token and 50% of your ETH that you provided. But now that means that the shape, say, of your payoff will be more resilient. So if the price goes up, if the price goes down, since you've shorted the token, you would be buying on the way down. But then since you have a short position, it decreases the steepness, I guess, of that curve from something that's, say, 100% to 50%. Same thing if it goes up. If the ranges changes and goes above your upper tick, then you have some ETH. You have to pay back the token, but the value goes in price. So you also have some type of downside, I guess, risk, which is 50% of your asset. But at the end of the day, if you remain within your range, then you can collect fees, and when you unwind your position, you can very easily pay back your debt if the price is close to where it started. You don't have to lose, I guess, through impermanent loss. You pay back your debt, get some ETH extra from the LP fees that you've collected, and that should be enough for you to be profitable.
Would that be 100% delta neutral, or is there still some risk there involved with that?
I mean, so again, it's delta neutral when it's exactly in the middle of your range, and if you go either to the to lower or higher values, then you're exposed. But the most you can be exposed to is kind of 50% risk. So again, if you're holding the token and the token goes down, you're 100% exposed. It goes down by $1, you lose a dollar. Now, because you've shorted half of it goes down by a dollar, you lose 50 cents. So typically, what you want to do is to choose a range again that corresponds to your timeline. Again, if it's 7%, it's every day. If it's 40%, it's every month. So we can say that within that month, if you're within that range, you would collect a steady stream of fees. If you're out of that range, the idea is that you want to still be profitable, or again, have an excess in value that's the tokens you've collected, that even though you leave the range, you still are net positive. So you can be stuck with 100% of the token, but since you've collected some fees, that can offset the loss. So again, the my own fork, it's on yubo.org, but you can actually visualize this. So you can see the payoff of a curve. This is very similar to the flow chart I sent, but you can also have now a hedge amount, and that can help you visualize if you are 0% hedged, which is you buy the token, lock your own ETH, and deploy it. But if you're 50% hedged, you borrow half of it. Or you can imagine the situation where you think that, say, Ribbon will go down in flames. You borrow Ribbon, you swap all of this to ETH, and then you put this in an LP position below the current price. So then when it goes down, you collect fees, and also you're short the assets, so you can actually be profitable. So again, the my app.yubo.org interface allows you to visualize this, but at the end of the day, most LPing is a positive delta strategy, and that's kind of what people have to realize is it's only profitable in the long term if you think the token will increase with respect to ETH. So if Ribbon you think will appreciate faster than ETH, then you can be profitable. Bad news that most to is that most tokens don't outperform ETH most of the time. That's why delta neutral or even slightly negative is kind of the way to go. And of
Awesome.
course,
I just tried to sorry, I tried to pin your flow chart. I wasn't able to. Go ahead, David.
I guess, no, of course, it's not financial advice, but I just try to provide tools that people can have a better understanding of what the what their returns are, I guess.
Of course. And like you said, when you're borrowing the tokens, your risk is more so not to the downside of the token because you could always repay it. It's more so to the if it leaves the range to the upside, correct?
Yeah, exactly. And again, this is in the world of options, you can be directional. Sometimes you think your stock or your asset will go down, so you can sell calls. If you think it's going to go up, you can sell puts. So now by having this shorting component to it, that enables you to be, again, delta neutral or negative delta, or even, again, negative delta. So that's kind of the framework I have in mind, is that everybody's assumptions are great. You just have to follow them through. And unless you're always positive in your outlook, if you don't use some type of shorting components, you are not fully utilizing the strategies that are available to you.
Of course. David, did you have anything to add to that, or?
Yeah, I mean, not a ton. Because I'm sitting around with a lot more thought into this, and I think that's very interesting.
Sorry, cut you off again, David. Your mic is very distant once again.
Any better now?
A little bit better.
Let me keep playing. Okay, how about now?
Yes, much better. Thank you.
Okay, cool. Yeah, let me know if it cuts out. It's these weird Bluetooth headphones. Yeah, again, I've never kind of tried any, I've never borrowed assets to LP, but that's a very interesting strategy. I guess I'll just kind of share the strategy I've used on V3, which is, pretty simple. One really nice thing on V3 is you've got different fee ranges, specifically the 1% fee tier. Now, of course, most trading volume will tend to, you've kind of got this like, balancing act of, the Uniswap UI will try to give the best price, which will select for lower tiers, but of course there needs to be liquidity there. So, you tend to see new assets launch in 1% pools, and then as they become mature, it kind of moves to lower and lower fee tiers, which is why even like, ETH USDC is now a lot of the liquidity is in the 5 basis point pool, and there's now even a 1 basis point pool, which I think it's mostly just stable pairs, but still. But the nice thing with the 1% pool, even if there's no liquidity there, or especially if there's no liquidity there, you will always get, as long as there's another pool, you'll always get arbitrage bots that will arbitrage you against the other pools, and you'll get some value. So my strategy sometimes has been to find 1% pools that have very low liquidity, but there's another pool that has very high liquidity. And you can kind of provide liquidity there. And since there's low liquidity in the 1% pool, you get the majority of the, or a high percentage of the fees that are accrued. And even if your fees are just coming from arbitrage bots, there's still enough activity to make you some nice returns. So that's been my strategy. I don't have much else to add.
Yeah, nice. So basically the strategy is to silo a larger pool with a, that may be a lower fee rate, that be a lower fee tier, and you would just provide in the 1% liquidity and capture that arbitrage volume, which is actually very smart, I think.
Yeah, especially now that Uniswap V3 is on 4 chains now, I think. You can even do, for a while I was in the ETH-USDC 1% pool on Polygon, which had pretty low liquidity in the 1% pool, but of course the other pools had pretty high liquidity, so I was earning some, that's not even like some crazy, low cap tokens. That was ETH-USDC, but I was still earning like a pretty nice return on that. So probably better return than if I was doing it on Ethereum mainnet. So that's a nice small fish move.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the thing also about small fish. Again, you can be a lot more nimble, I guess, in your strategies, and you can adjust much more easily than if you have to handle, again, millions of dollars worth of liquidity. So at the end of the day, that's also why I like options so much. The small little guy can actually profit at a slightly higher expected value than, say, the larger funds because of their size. So again, yeah, that's certainly one strategy that... So identifying the pools that have not enough liquidity is also a very, very important step. So as David mentioned, even so the same asset may have multiple fee tiers, looking at the returns per pool allows you to derive which one would kind of give you more return proportionally to your size. And again, the shilling my Yubo. So I have the analytics interface of, I've forked the analytic interface of Uniswap. It's info.yubo.org. And one key quantity that you have to watch or at least monitor is the implied volatility of a pool. So again, as I mentioned, you have the ETH ribbon, which was in the thousands of percent. This was a direct consequence of not having enough liquidity in the pool to match the trading volume. Sometimes you have too much liquidity and that depresses the IV. So when you have multiple pools, say ETHUSDC 0.5%, 0.05%, 0.3%, and 1%, sometimes there's an imbalance in the liquidity, and some days it can be more worthwhile to go to the 0.05%, some days in the 1%. So that's where you look at the IV, the implied volatility, that allows you to kind of identify which pools are the most would have an imbalance that could be temporarily restored by more users providing liquidity to that pool.
Yeah, great. I mean, it's an interesting thing you say there. When you look for pools that are not sort of liquid, and you add liquidity to those pools, you definitely have an advantage there. But you know, traditionally, right now with markets, they do get pretty efficient with some of these tokens, and they all do have decent liquidity. But like, that is some alpha right there for anyone listening. Like, if you could, not financial advice, but if you do find pools that seem to be under, don't have enough liquidity there, then there is some opportunities. I want to talk about one other thing before we start wrapping this up. I want to talk about how a lot of people just sort of say that AMMs in general are just not an efficient way of creating liquidity. And most of the people and most of the criticism that comes around this usually is from professional market makers who run like high frequency trading shops on centralized exchanges. And they sort of have these like really complex strategies on how they market make. And so to them, what they say is that like when you're on an AMM, you're essentially capturing a stale pricing. And I guess the industry term for that is like toxic flow, which is, you know, it might sound like a little bit harsher than it is, but what they're saying is that like when you get volume only mainly from a time when like the price is that different from what the AMM is pricing. And so you get this sort of stale pricing arbitrage that comes through, and that's what gives it the volume. I mean, I personally feel like, you know, to the point of what you guys were just saying, how Uniswap V3 is sort of really democratic and allows, or AMMs in general, just allow for smaller fish to participate in these. I feel like that's really empowering. But I also want to get your take on like how accurate this is by like, you know, these professional market makers that sort of criticize AMMs for you know, the quote unquote toxic flow that they're accruing value from.
Yeah, and one comment perhaps is that some of this toxic flow exists when there's a centralized exchange. For instance, you can ARB to, or there's an extra price source that you have to match. And this is maybe what I see this in the future, but when a token is brand new and they launch on, say, a decentralized exchange, this is probably the situation where I guess LPs can benefit the most, because they're not, again, subjected to these arbitrage or, again, this toxic flow that happens. So I would say that as the DeFi space increases, and if we're not all getting bankrupt over the next couple of months, if we can survive this bear market, we can see that as more and more markets are launched, at some point, Uniswap already sometimes exceeds centralized exchanges like Coinbase's volume daily. We can see this kind of expand more with layer twos, and that would be kind of a more native way of LPing for the small fish, but also of trading. So I can imagine that some of the limitations of arbitrage or a lot of the market making firms kind of edge perhaps they have could disappear when you get a market where most of the trading happens on chain.
Yeah, to kind of address a little more like the comparison or some of these criticisms from professional market makers, you know, order book exchanges are still like kind of the more for a very liquid market, it's still the more efficient way to be trading. But it's very limiting in terms of who can market make, right? Like it requires active market making, which is, you know, these days usually kind of an algorithm on some servers. But, you know, the interesting thing with Uniswap V2 was it was like purely passive. You just provide liquidity and you let the blockchain kind of like run its way, which, as you said, it was in some ways kind of democratizing. It allowed anybody, you know, a big trading firm could, or a big trading firm can add liquidity to Uniswap, and a small fish can add liquidity to Uniswap, and they both will get, you know, basically the same returns. The thing that I think is really interesting with Uniswap v3 is it kind of tries to give you the best of both worlds. A one tick liquidity position is pretty close to a order on an order book exchange, and a full range position on Uniswap v3 is basically the same thing as a normal position on Uniswap v2. So you can kind of get pick your how active you want to be. Again, Gil was talking about, when you're picking a position, think what is your how long do you want to hold that position for? Do you want to hold it for a minute, an hour, a day, a year? And that's going to inform how wide you want to make your position. So I think V3 is really amazing that it is something that really powerful active market makers can execute complex strategies, and the more passive participants can still kind of create a position that's kind of handles itself. Now, of course, you're gonna end up giving a high percentage of the returns to the more active ones that are picking tight ranges, but that's just kind of the game. And at the end of the day, we talked. You mentioned kind of, oh, is Uniswap v3 like targeted for professional market makers? Uniswap is the goal, that the target end user is the trader, and the optimizations that Uniswap makes are kind of always in terms of how can we give the best trading experience? How can this be the place people want to trade? So, when I hear people saying, oh, Uniswap v3 is a failure because it's more complex, the trading on Uniswap v3 hasn't gotten any more complex at all. It's still, you go to the Uniswap website, it's still like incredibly simple. The market making has gotten a bit more complex, but market makers are not the users, they're kind of the workers of the protocol. They get paid for their service, they earn fees, but they're not the kind of goal end user. The goal end user is to provide the best pricing for users to trade assets.
That's a fantastic point, and I want to add, yeah, David. So this is exactly the reason why I started to dig very deep into the Uniswap v3, because I wanted to be a bit more successful on my own trading, and that enabled me to kind of discover many strategies, as I mentioned, the flow charts. But overall, we kind of are seeing that again, the swapping business is extremely efficient. You put your tokens in and out, and this is very easy. But the liquidity providing part is still a bit more difficult to take a grasp of. And again, if I want to see what I'm working on, but yes, I'm working on Panoptic, which is kind of perhaps enhancing the abilities of market makers and liquidity providers to provide liquidity into Uniswap. And again, if you think of LP positions in terms of options, then you can be a lot more strategic in your LPing. You can actually create delta neutral strategies, bearish, bullish, but in a single transaction that may not require you to borrow assets or to short assets on a different protocol. So at the end of the day, we kind of unravel this key piece of information, which is Uniswap v3 LPing is selling options. And we by approaching it this way, you can be more successful. But also because we unravel this, now we can sell options. So you can buy options, I mean. So what we will be launching at with Panoptic is not only better tools for LPs, but also better tools for traders that may want to buy options. People know about GameStop, you can buy calls, you can also buy puts to protect against your downside risk. So this is something that can happen very organically and naturally within a Uniswap pool. This is where I can again keep an eye open for Panoptic, but this is what we will be launching soon.
Well, very interesting. So it's going to be like a options protocol based on Uni V3. I'm very excited to see that, to be honest. And it actually touches on the last thing I wanted to talk about before we let the audience maybe chime in for some questions, is what do you think are like some really exotic, cool things that could be built on Uniswap V3 that maybe haven't been a sort of an uncharted territory? I mean, you mentioned Panoptic, which is really exciting, interesting. I'm excited to see what's possible with that. I actually I'm a member of the Lyra community where, they're big options fans. So anything that is in the options space, I'm excited to learn about right now. Although I'm do not understand options fully at 100%, but like very intrigued by them in general. But what do you guys see in terms of like what is possible on Uniswap V3 or what could possibly be conceptually done using Uniswap V3 that maybe isn't hasn't is in uncharted territory?
I feel like I've definitely had this thought a bunch of times of like, ah, here's a cool use case for V3. I'm not having a ton jump to mind now. I mean, kind of one of the obvious ones is to just have more simpler, like fungible staking, or sorry, liquidity providing services on top. I know there's a bunch of projects that tried to provide that. I think Gelato seems to be the one that has the most traction right now, but I know there's a few others competing. Yeah, that's the one that I think comes to mind now. One, I don't know if it's exactly something built on top, but one use case that I would like to see more is one interesting thing with these kind of single-sided positions that you can do on Uniswap V3 is means when a pool is created, you can create a pool that is entirely one asset. So I think it'd be cool to see a token launch where the launch involves just adding like potentially full range liquidity across the entire curve on Uniswap V3, and you can even, a project could do that and then burn their position to essentially like lock in some liquidity to the pool forever, because again, the project launching can, kind of create tokens for free at that point. But yeah, I'm curious to see if Gil has other cool ideas in mind.
Yeah, so maybe spinning off on David's point, you could imagine again. I asked myself the same questions, I guess, starting last summer, and then the good news that I'm actually working to implement this and launching a product that at least realizes some of the vision I have for Uniswap V3. And so, just to riff off of David's idea, you can have a call option airdrop where you do distribute call options, which would be LP positions, and then users choose whenever they want to cash it, which would be burning the position. But at the end of the day, that could be one way to distribute tokens. And another way, and then I'll leave it as that, but you can imagine a ribbon-like vault, but instead of being a single strategy, it could be a dynamic one. So you can have a delta neutral ribbon vault or whatever protocol wishes to be, but you can actually now be a lot more strategic in the vault business because you can have access to short puts, but also short calls, long put, and long calls, and create very exotic payoffs. And also one last point is that the reason why I myself like to trade options so much is that it's very capital efficient. So again, Uniswap V3 is a lot more capital efficient than Uni V2. But if you deal with this in terms of options, you can be, again, several times more capital efficient. You can create a synthetic token position that pays the same way as if you were to hold the actual asset, but it only costs you a quarter of the collateral if you want. So at the end of the day, the fact that we can unlock an options market, the fact that we can unlock new strategies could actually also generate better yield for users, but also stabilizes prices overall, which is something that perhaps crypto markets are in desperate need right now.
Yeah, definitely. I wonder if there's any sort of ability to, if it's possible to like deploy some sort of machine learning strategy on chain where it's all fully on chain and like with no off chain sort of management of like the algorithm. I wonder if that's feasible or if I'm just like fantasizing. Do you think that something's possible?
Maybe, and I think, and the key point is that there's probably not one solution fits all. If you know your risk, someone can be risk averse, someone can be highly resistant to risk taking, and that will dictate their position. So maybe the machine learning will have a variety of strategies. Again, a little bit more cautious, highly risky, and then bounces over all risky. But at the end of the day, the key point is that every user, that's why also the small users can benefit. Every user can tailor their risk. They can use the exact position that matches that risk. They don't have to rely on someone else or maybe some other protocol to manage it for them. If you want to take the risk, you're kind of in control of it, which is kind of what makes options and also LP ingradable.
Yeah, definitely. And there's one other thing that sort of came to my mind in terms of like what's possible in Uni V3, and this is in particular with the staking contract. And I was thinking like I don't know how viable this is, but someone could potentially create modify the staking contract such that it only provides liquidity. Let's say like there's two tokens in the pool. Let's say you want to only incentivize liquidity for the stablecoin side, and let's say it's ETH USDC, and you want to only reward liquidity that is in range on the one side and not on the other side. So you don't want to incentivize a lot of liquidity like on the one side of the curve, but you want a lot of liquidity on the other side of the curve. Like, do you think that's possible to modify the rewards contract such that it only rewards like active liquidity in the maybe on the one side of the curve and not the other? And then like, is that even viable, like a viable strategy? Do you think it would fall apart or like it'd have some negative feedback loop?
I mean, maybe David can talk about the actual contracts itself if it's possible. But again, it's all up to your assumption. If your token, if you want to favor one side of the liquidity curve, let's say, that means that you have perhaps a bearish or bullish outlook. So I guess I'm sure token protocols will have a bearish outlook. So you could say do provide liquidity in a way that benefits the token because there's more liquidity on one side, which means it pushes the price the other way. But I guess it could also be now I think it could be easy to change the contract that instead in addition to specifying a width, which is how the distance between your lower tick and upper tick, you could also say that the current tick or the one that's traded has to be within one side, say 60% of the way towards the upper tick. That could be one way to kind of incentivize a skewed distribution of liquidity that way.
Yeah, to kind of just those two things to go back to what you're saying about like a fully on-chain like algorithm for managing liquidity. I mean, I don't know, how kind of feasible that algorithm is, but if someone can create an algorithm, I think the really interesting thing is, right now computation on layer one Ethereum is very expensive, but the place that computation is not expensive is layer two Ethereum. So, roll-ups like Arbitrum and Optimism. So I think it'd be really interesting if, there's kind of a new design space there. Where we can potentially have much more complex calculations to kind of manage positions on layer twos. In terms of what you're saying about kind of trying to re reward single-sided positions, I'm trying to think through. I think that would be feasible. I'm not 100% sure. One thing it reminded me of is there was a project. I'm not sure if you guys, I don't remember the name. Maybe some of you guys do, but a project that was essentially kind of using V3 to kind of shift their liquidity up and up and up. It kind of had this very like Ponzi dynamic where, the price would move up a bit and this kind of like buy wall would get shifted up. And, it of course led to this really crazy Ponzi explosion and collapse where the price soared because it was kind of there was so much liquidity preventing selling the token and there was some token incentives for it to go up. But of course, the thing with V3 liquidity is even if you have a really big, like, essentially a buy wall, once you eat through that buy wall, then the thing just collapses. So that was what happened to this project is the token skyrocketed because of this interesting strategy they were doing. And then it skyrocketed so much that there was enough sell pressure to overcome the buy wall and the thing collapsed like 90 something percent. So, that's kind of the degen side of kind of strategies that you can take with Uniswap V3.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of, sorry, go ahead, yeah.
So you say that it going down 90% is, after all, a pretty good investment in the current climate, actually.
Yes, several tokens are down 90% more than once, so down 80% and then down 90% again. It
That's true.
is pretty rough.
I'm curious how much that token is down today.
But that what you're saying is actually pretty much what I was kind of conceptualizing. Apologies, but I feel like you're right. It would create a situation where the token would at some point would reach a price that is above fair value, and then there would be this sort of like large sell wall that someone could sell into, and then break it down, and it would just from there would be not much liquidity to add. So it would yeah, it would likely be problematic in many ways. But I think it's probably feasible for like a short time period, or like for maybe very particular instances. Like every tool is used for different things, right? You don't use every tool for every instance, but like I think it could work. But I for the most part, when I think about it, you're probably right, David. It would create sort of a bit of a Ponzi situation and like a unstable price for a large for at some point eventually the token would be overvalued and it wouldn't be able to sustain.
Yeah, and that's kind of one of the downsides, I guess, of UnivE3 is that it's really amazing when when the token is moving in a predictable range that liquidity can really concentrate in those ranges. When you have big movements, you can potentially move into a range where there's very low liquidity, and if that's the if Uniswap is the primary source of liquidity, then that means the price can really move significantly. Or the other side, even if there is significant liquidity elsewhere. Uniswap V3, one kind of Side benefit unrelated to everything we've discussed is it's got this really much nicer like on-chain Oracle system. But again, if there's really concentrated liquidity and then the liquidity moves out of that concentrated range, then it becomes very cheap to move the price of that asset. And you could kind of do some potential like price manipulation attacks depending on the asset and the amount of liquidity.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Okay, our audience has been very patient. Sorry for the interruption. It appears that we do not have many other questions. I'm just going to look at the GovCall chat. I do not see anything there. Yeah, okay. Thank you. Apologies again for the interruption, everybody. Thank you to everyone else who joined. Thank you, Gil, David. It was a great space. Awesome. Very informative for me, and I'm sure for our community. I'm going to record it and then post it again on Twitter so that everyone could see it. Definitely, you guys answered a lot of questions around sort of the ribbon situation in particular, where there's a lot of misconceptions and a lot of inaccurate information, in my opinion, on it. But you guys definitely provided a lot of insight there. So thank you so much.
Thank you guys. It was super fun.
Yeah, it was fun. Thanks, Mini. Thanks, Matt,
No
too.
problem. Yeah, Matt, he's not here anymore, but yeah, he hosted the first half of the call. Thank you to the audience. Thank you, everyone. Have a great day and enjoy.
Right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Sure.